From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at NPR Election Headquarters in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now, and we are live this hour with analysis and results. It has been an epic 24 hours in American politics. Donald Trump is the president-elect. Here he is last night.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time.
And Hillary Clinton said this today.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it. It also enshrines other things: the rule of law, the principle that we are all equal in rights and dignity, freedom of worship and expression. We respect and cherish these values too, and we must defend them.
Let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, I know you've been digesting this all day along with all of your colleagues at NPR. I'm just curious, what is your sense of whether this division can be healed and what kind of a White House, you being the White House correspondent, we might be looking at with Donald Trump?
Well, the divisions are very deep. Something like half the country woke up this morning horrified at the thought that Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States. And had Hillary Clinton won the election, something like half the country would have woken up horrified by that. We are a deeply divided populace right now. Donald Trump sounded a conciliatory tone early this morning when he delivered his victory speech. And you heard Hillary Clinton there talk about how he deserves a chance to show he can actually deliver on that. You also heard her sort of hint that we're going to be watching, because not very much in his campaign suggested that kind of inclusive spirit. So it'll be very interesting to see what sort of president he is.
Yeah.
You know, he changed so many times throughout the campaign on a number of issues. I think a lot of people are wondering, is he now going to change again and be more conciliatory, or is he going to try to appeal to the people who put him in office?
Well, here's the thing. Issues were not really Donald Trump's thing. He could be very impulsive, as when he called for the ban on Muslim immigrants. He could be flexible, as when he trimmed the sails on his tax plan, although fiscal hawks say it's still a budget buster. But he was not somebody who had a thick stack of policy papers. He was an improviser, a dancer, a jabber, not somebody who is easy to pin down. And we'll see if that continues once he's actually in the Oval Office.
Well, and who might go with him into the Oval Office? Mara Liasson, your colleague, told us earlier that we might see an AG Rudy Giuliani or Chris Christie in a cabinet. Who are the people that will be around him?
Newt Gingrich has been talked about as a potential Secretary of State. But, you know, Donald Trump keeps a fairly lean staff. His staff was about one-tenth the size of Hillary Clinton's during the campaign. That's similar to what he has at the Trump Organization. It's a fairly lean, nimble staff. There's not a lot of hierarchy or a typical organizational chart for an enterprise the size of his business. He looks for people who are fiercely loyal to him, and he's not overly concerned with sort of traditional credentials.
That's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
My pleasure.
And we've got two other guests joining us now. Eric Rauchway, professor of history at the University of California, Davis. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, and we're also joined by Maria Elena Salinas, Univision news anchor. Maria, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
And let's start with you, Maria Elena. The Latino vote, we talked about a surge in certain places. Obviously, it wasn't enough in most places to put Hillary Clinton over the top. What happened?
Well, there was a surge, definitely. And I think we saw that with the numbers that doubled and tripled the amount of people of Hispanics who came out for early voting. It's too soon to know exactly how many Latinos voted on a national level, but it could be also in historic numbers. But like you said, it didn't happen in the states where it needed to happen, although there is always a silver lining. We look at Arizona. a state where Sheriff Joe Arpaio was ousted because of his persecution of immigrants. We see a state like Nevada, which Hillary won and that elected its first Latina to the Senate and also the first immigrant, Mexican immigrant, to Congress. But I'm sure that Latinos are very concerned right now because they were urged to go out and vote, and some might be questioning whether their vote counted or not. And they need to understand that it did count. And one of the amazing things is that today, the reaction is fear. It's not just disappointment because my team lost. It's fear.
Yeah. Well, a notable Latina who has been very much against Donald Trump tweeted this out today. Our government is based on a system of checks and balances. And trust me, I'll be one hell of a check on Donald Trump. And she is Catherine Cortez Masto, who last night became the first Latina elected to the U.S. Senate. She beat Joe Heck in Nevada, holding on to retiring Senator Harry Reid's seat. So there is that. I mean, there is someone who's saying, I leapfrogged in and I'll be participating.
Yeah, definitely. That she is there, and I think it's important. And I think this might encourage more Latinos to actually run for office, not just go out and vote, but participate in as many ways as they can possibly participate. And yes, I think one of the things that has really amazed people is that now Republicans will hold all the different sources of power, not only the presidency, but Congress, and possibly also the Supreme Court. So you do need to have some checks and balances, and at least there will be some people out there that will be making sure that they try to stop some of the most extreme proposals that Donald Trump made during his campaign.
Well, Maria Elena, we spoke with Senator Roger Wicker earlier today, Republican, who we asked about the idea of deporting those who are in the U.S. illegally. He said, well, look, President Obama deports people. He kind of downplayed that idea. Is there fear among Latinos today that especially undocumented immigrants are going to be rounded up and deported?
They're not only fearful, they're petrified that that will happen. And there's a big difference between the deportations from Obama, and it's true, he is a president that deported the most amount of immigrants than any other president. Most of them, of course, those who had a criminal record. But I think that one of the things that makes people so scared is the tone of the campaign. Because he used words like immigrants being criminals and being drug dealers and being rapists and to, you know, kids were listening to that and they were talking maybe about their grandfather. Maybe they're calling the grandfather criminal. They felt that maybe they were calling their uncle a rapist. So I think that it was the words and the tone of the campaign that created that fear among Latinos of being deported and being separated. And we've done a lot of reporting precisely on kids going to school, being bullied for being immigrants and fearful that when they come home, they're going to be separated from their parents.
That's Maria Elena Salinas, Univision News anchor. Maria, thank you.
Thank you.
We want to bring in Eric Rauchway, professor of history at the University of California, Davis. Also, he's written a book called The Moneymakers about FDR's economic policies. And I want to switch gears to that topic, Eric, because a huge part of the impetus of the Trump voter was lack of jobs in pockets of the country. And he promised that industry would come back. Other analysts are telling us that industry might not be able to come back in some of these pockets. How does he square that for these people who really have faith in him? Actually, Jeremy was on the road with somebody who said, I hope he gives me a job, who think that they're going to give him jobs.
Well, he's got a difficult road ahead. You know, the promises that he's made as far as economic policy go have included restricting trade using tariffs. That's the principal one that seems to be aimed at restoring jobs to America's Midwest, which seemed to have netted him quite a few votes in that area. Mm-hmm. As I'm sure you've I've had folks tell you already, the net gains from engaging in trade wars around the world are probably not going to be high if they exist at all. So it's probably not going to work out for him. On the other hand, if he builds a wall, that would be a big infrastructure project. He could probably employ a lot of folks that way.
Well, Eric Rauchway, you're on the West Coast, and if there is a blue wall for Hillary Clinton, it was the West Coast. From Washington State all the way down through California and Nevada and Oregon, she won big out there. How does this election look from the West Coast, which has gotten more and more Democratic over the years?
Well, the West Coast, as you know, does not look like Donald Trump's America. California in particular is probably going to be the thing that gives Hillary Clinton her edge in the nationwide popular vote, even though she's going to lose the Electoral College. And that's going to give us an anomalous position in presidential history. California is a state that looks, as Donald Trump says, America can't look, which is to say that it's ethnically diverse. Its largest ethnic group is Latinos, and yet it's got a very high real GDP per capita. It taxes itself very highly, and in fact, after this year's propositions, it's going to tax itself even more highly. Hmm. It's got a pretty good state welfare state and public services. And, you know, it's an economy that seems to be working. It might even be said to be great.
Well, Eric Rauchway, professor of history at the University of California, Davis. Well, the legalization of recreational marijuana was just one of 17 measures on California's ballot. Joining us from Sacramento to talk about some of the other results there is Ben Adler, Capital Bureau Chief for Capital Public Radio. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Robin.
And we go to California because often as goes California, goes the rest of the country. So let's talk about some of the other ballots that were there. Two propositions on the death penalty, Prop 62 calling for repeal of the death penalty, 66 for speeding up implementation of death sentences. What happened?
Well, voters rejected the push to eliminate capital punishment in California, and it was the second time in 4 years that voters have rejected that. And in fairly similar margins, this one lost by roughly 8 percentage points, 54 to 46. The push to streamline the process is currently leading by about 2 percentage points, 150,000 votes, but with millions of votes remaining to be counted in California because there are so many vote-by-mail ballots here, this one could swing back the other way. If it does, it would be interesting because if supporters and opponents of the death penalty could agree on one thing in California, it's that the process is broken. And yet voters in the end may end up saying, you know what, we're just going to go with the status quo.
Okay. Prop 56 called for raising taxes on tobacco. What happened?
It passed. It passed a big 63% to 37%. That was despite tens of millions of dollars in ads run by the tobacco industry. Supporters also had a well-funded campaign helped in part by Tom Steyer, who was the venture capitalist and Democratic mega donor. So that one passed. And it's interesting because 4 years ago, voters rejected a tobacco tax increase. But this time it got through, as did another tax extension on income taxes on the wealthiest Californians.
Okay, 61, Prop 61 has to do with prescription drug pricing. It gets a little netty, but basically it prohibits the state from buying prescription drugs at a higher price than the Department of Veterans Affairs. We understand that one's not called yet, but tell us more about that.
Well, it has a big lead. I'm sorry, the no side. Forgive me. The no side has a big lead of more than 600,000 votes, but the AP is still not calling it yet. And there's some question about whether that this 8-point gap could narrow as these late ballots come in.
Mm-hmm.
This was just a full frontal assault on the pharmaceutical industry, and the pharmaceutical industry fought back. More than $120 million in spending on TV ads and mailers and billboards. This is a measure that started out with a big lead and had a big populist appeal. Stick it to Big Pharma. Well, Big Pharma ended up sticking it to supporters of this measure, we think, although it is, again, too soon to call, according to the Associated Press.
A couple other propositions in California. Again, when California does something, some of the other states sometimes listen. The ban on single-use plastic and paper bags, not called yet, but has a small lead. A lot of towns are already doing that across the country. Prop 63, gun control. Stricter measures on gun control, firearms and ammunition sales. Passed. And Prop 58 ends the mandate on English-only education in California. This is going to make it easier for classrooms to have bilingual programs.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard it said that it's not necessarily just for English as a second language students, but also maybe for native English speakers who want to have be immersed in second language programs. This isn't there were 17 measures on the ballot, and I don't know this one as well as I know some of the others. But I will say that it passed with a higher percent and with more votes than any other of these 17 statewide measures. So it had broad support throughout the state.
That's Ben Adler, Capital Bureau Chief at Capital Public Radio. Ben, thank you.
You're welcome.
And let's bring back in our studio buddy this hour, Eric Rauchway, professor of history at the University of California, Davis. Eric Rauchway, one of the things I'm wondering about is why was turnout so low, lowest voter turnout across the country since 2000?
Well, I don't think we're going to know for sure until we see more sophisticated polling on this. But we do know for sure that this is the first election since the passage of the Voting Rights Act without the first protections of the Voting Rights Act, which means that voter suppression might have been easier in some areas, especially among some ethnic groups.
Yeah.
But well, also, okay. there were a lot of people who were not suppressed in the way that you're talking about, but just didn't show.
Right. Well, I mean, we don't know for sure until we see better data. But yes, there's some people who didn't show, and that's stereotypically a product of an overwhelmingly negative campaign with overwhelmingly unpopular candidates.
We are joined now by U.S. Congressman Dave Bratt, who is a Republican representing Virginia's 7th District, who won re-election yesterday and who's been a strong supporter of Donald Trump for president. Congressman, welcome.
Hey, Jeremy. Well, great to be on.
Well, it's great to have you, and I want to start with a question about the House of Representatives. Do you think that Paul Ryan will remain the speaker?
Depends. He gave a press conference this morning. It was very good. He said it was epic-making, you know, historic election, the likes of which no one has ever seen in their lifetime, and that Trump has identified something new that no one had seen previously to have such a win through the Rust Belt and the Midwest, et cetera. And so if our leadership is listening like that and they can identify what that new secret sauce is, then I think there's good hope for our leadership. Right? But they got to put it in concrete and identify specifically in policy what Trump has identified there. And he's identified that you got to take care of the middle class and manufacturing, job loss, trade deals. It's kind of cynical to say free trade when we don't have free markets in this country, right? We've got $2.6 trillion in regulatory overhang on our small business.
Well, do you think the Republican Party is going to go along with Donald Trump being anti-free trade, saying he wants to rip up trade agreements, including NAFTA?
Yeah, well, I got a PhD in economics, and he's not really anti-free trade. It's cynical. That's what I was saying in terms of saying that free trade is about free markets. When you got $2.6 trillion in regulatory burden coming from the federal government in this country, you don't have free markets in any sector. And so our guys, our small businesses, are competing. And then we say, hey, we're going to open up to China and India. They don't have any of this costly regulation. Good luck to you. You know, I hope you guys do well. And they get tanked, of course, because we're killing them. And Obama premiums are going up 20% in Virginia and up to 100% out west in a few states. And so to put our guys in direct competition in the global market with other folks who don't have any costs comparative, it's not a level playing field. And so Trump has identified that, and that's the source of the win, right? We're getting rolled by China and Russia and et cetera.
So you think he'll be renegotiating NAFTA, maybe not ripping it up, but changing it. What do you think Trump needs to do to reach out to the many people, in fact, more people that didn't vote for him than did vote for him?
Yeah, well, I've recommended to him, I think the three things that made this country the greatest country on the face of the earth is the Judeo-Christian tradition, and out of that comes the rule of law, Moses, the human rights tradition, and the St. Augustine, St. Thomas, and all that kind of stuff. And then if you're really lucky, you get Adam Smith, a famous Presbyterian in 1776, who develops the free market system. And so if he reaches out to our African-American and Hispanic brothers and sisters in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and speaks that language, we should have a great conversation. And I hope he does reach out along those lines. Those are the first principles we all share. It doesn't mean you have to believe in a certain religion, but that tradition. I'm from Virginia. Madison and Jefferson were most proud in their life's work of their statutes on religious toleration. And that has been the bedrock for the foundation of this country since the beginning. And people have lost track. The First Amendment says, no establishment of religion, that's true and that's good, but also no stopping the free expression thereof.
Right.
And that's important. These are our first principles that we all believe. Human rights comes out of that love, right? Love pops into the Western lexicon at the year zero.
Got to cut you off right there. Got to cut you off, Congressman Dave Bratt. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks.
Let's go now to Missouri, where Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton by a wide margin, 57-38%. And Republican Senator Roy Blunt fended off a tough challenger to keep his seat. Peggy Lowe of Here Now contributor KCUR reports.
66-year-old incumbent Roy Blunt beat Democrat Jason Kander, the Secretary of State, in what had been a close race. Blunt met his supporters at a Springfield hotel early today and talked about the remarkable Republican sweep in Missouri, which made red virtually every office, including the governor and all the way down the ticket.
Never in the history of the state have we reelected majorities in the Missouri General Assembly, the House and the Senate, reelected a senator, and elected five statewide Republican officials.
If Blunt sounded surprised, he wasn't alone. The Senate race pitted a Washington insider versus an outsider, two men from two very different generations, and polling showed the contest in a dead heat going into Election Day.
I had a call about 30 minutes ago from Secretary Kander, and it was a generous call. It was a generous, both a concession call and a congratulatory call, and what a fight he put up.
After midnight, Kander met with a few Democrats left at a theater in Kansas City, many already having downed their beers and a few even shedding some tears over the presidential returns. Much like he did on the campaign trail, the 35-year-old Kander focused on his young supporters. He had hoped to become the first millennial to serve in the Senate. He urged others his age not to give up just because they lost.
This is a generation that is capable of greatness and is a numerous generation, and it has a lot of work left to do. Thank you. Stay with it. Thank you.
The race set a record $46 million in spending by outside groups and helped the Republicans keep their majority in the U.S. Senate. For Here and Now, I'm Peggy Lowe in Kansas City, Missouri.
Well, in Donald Trump's 100-day action plan, which he laid out in October in a speech at Gettysburg, he said that on his first day in office, after canceling every executive order issued by President Obama, he would begin the process of selecting a new Supreme Court justice from one of the 20 on his list. What is ahead for the court? Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi there, Robin.
And when Justice Scalia died last February, Donald Trump was one of the first to call for stonewalling President Obama's nominee. Remember, he said it's called delay, delay, delay. More recently, some Republicans were saying out loud, well, you know, if Clinton wins, maybe we don't need a new justice. We can just go along with eight. Now we might get one with a Republican Congress very quickly under Donald Trump. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think there was a really interesting split in the last few weeks where Senate Republicans, particularly ones in tight races, Robin, were saying two very different things. We heard some senators, John McCain, Richard Burr, saying, you know what, let's stonewall for a long, long time. We heard Ted Cruz saying, hey, eight is enough, seven might be better. And then we heard, as you say, people like Jeff Flake, even Chuck Grassley saying, we're not going to stonewall forever. Let's get this done. And so I think even within Senate Republicans, there was a little bit of off messaging about how long they were going to keep this seat empty under Hillary Clinton. As you say, that all goes away because now we get to put up one of Donald Trump's judges. And more pointedly, having lost the Senate, the Democrats can't do anything to stop it. So I think really that 9 months of stonewalling really, really paid off for Republicans in the Senate and for Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't seem to have hurt them at all, even though I think since 1900, the Senate has never failed to confirm a Supreme Court nominee in a presidential election year. So transparently because of an impending election. So Trump has released this short list of potential nominees, 20, most judges, and then one senator, Utah Republican Mike Lee. Is there a sense of who this appointee would be?
Well, he did it in two shifts. And first of all, we have to point out how deeply strange it is to get a menu from a presidential nominee who's like, here, I'm going to pick one of these. That doesn't often happen. But he put out initially a list of 11 potential picks. They were all white. They were almost all men. And interestingly, there was no one from the sort of inside the beltway, you know, his drain the swamp way of thinking about things. And so really important, I think, conservative legal actors like Paul Clement, former Solicitor General, Brett Kavanaugh from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals were actually left off this list. This was a list of outsiders. He added 10 more names, I think, attempting to have some women and a little bit of racial diversity. So he added some more names in September. But it's also worth pointing out that even as he gave us this menu, Trump was quick to say, this is just a guide. This is not actually a comprehensive list of my picks. It's these are the kind of folks I want. And it does raise the question that maybe he's going to pull a kind of George W. Bush, Harriet Meyer switcheroo, where having put up these very anti-choice, very pro-gun, you know, very, very by-the-book conservative legal actors, he may, in fact, just do something completely wacky and surprise everyone. Certainly, he left that opening.
That list came out when he was trying to convince conservatives that he was one of them, a constitutionalist. Well, you said some Republicans were saying, hey, eight's fine, seven may be better. You have three justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who had a big spat with Donald Trump recently, Anthony Kennedy, 80, Stephen Breyer, 78. They may not want to be doing this hard work. There may be many openings for President Trump.
Right. That's so important. You know, I think that if the only net effect of this election is that Donald Trump gets to replace Justice Scalia with another rock-ribbed Republican, no net change. Anthony Kennedy remains the swing voter at the court. But you're completely right. Ginsburg, 83, Anthony Kennedy, 80, Breyer, 78. Those are three of the five justices who voted in the big reproductive rights case last year, in the big affirmative action case last year. In other words, you are looking at almost, I think, completely, if one of them leaves, a new era, the end of Roe, the end of gun rights, or the beginning of new gun rights, the beginning of new bolstering of Citizens United. And these are, you know, as you say, Donald Trump overtly promised these things.
Yeah. That's Dahlia Lithwick. She covers the Supreme Court for Slate. Dahlia, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Robin, the news is still coming in right now, even though we know who the president is going to be. But we're finding out now, AP saying in California, voters have rejected that ballot measure seeking to curb prescription drug prices paid by the state that you were speaking about earlier this hour. And Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, saying he is going to work to repeal Obamacare very quickly. So he's already working on that. He's called it today one of the worst pieces of legislation out of a lot of bad ones. Well, Eric Rauchway is still with us, professor of history at the University of California, Davis. Eric Rauchway, has anything happened today, as we hear from Mitch McConnell and others, that has given you any better of a sense of what the next 4 years are going to be like?
Well, I think we're hearing the kinds of things that one would have predicted we would hear for a Trump presidency if it's coupled with a Republican Congress of the kind that we've seen since the beginning of the Obama administration, which is to say, the Republicans, particularly Mitch McConnell, have said right the way along, going back to 2009, that their job was to ensure that Obama failed and to try to obstruct efforts to pass legislation during that era. And they've so it's not just the Garland nomination that they've been stonewalling. It's pretty much the entire Obama agenda for the better part now of these 8 years. And now they've got their chance. Mm-hmm. So that's not surprising that Obamacare is up for the chop and that a Supreme Court nominee to replace Justice Scalia will be very quickly in the works. I think it's a bigger question as to what we might see from Trump on the executive action front. As you know, going back to at least Franklin Roosevelt, and indeed for much of the 20th century, Congress has granted the President of the United States increasing unilateral authority, especially in matters of foreign policy. And there's a lot of things that a President Trump could do on his own without the cooperation of Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan that we still don't know what he'll do since he hasn't been entirely precise about his own agenda.
That's Eric Rauchway, professor of history at the University of California, Davis. You mentioned FDR, your latest book, The Moneymakers. It is about FDR's economic policies. And it'll be fascinating to see, Professor and Jeremy. Donald Trump wants to bring back coal. He wants to start more fossil fuel production. And we'll just have to stand back and see how this unfolds. Professor Rauchway, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Donald Trump won all 20 electoral votes in Pennsylvania, narrowly beating Hillary Clinton 49-48% in that state. And Republicans there held onto a critical Senate seat as freshman Pat Toomey won a narrow re-election victory. Dave Davies of Here and Now contributor WHYY has more.
Thank you, Pennsylvania.
It was an uphill battle for Pat Toomey all year. Democrats turn out in big numbers in presidential years in Pennsylvania, and having Donald Trump at the top of the ticket didn't help Toomey's efforts to appeal to moderates and independents. He pretty much dodged the question of whether he'd support Trump to the very end. It was the nation's most expensive Senate race ever, as Toomey noted in his victory speech.
And let's face it, this was a tough campaign. This was quite a battle. There was an all-time record amount of money spent against us. A lot of the ads were just outright false. But, you know, the voters were smart enough to figure it out, as they usually are.
Outside spending was heavy on both sides, totaling $115 million, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Four-fifths of that was spent on attack ads and mailings against Toomey and his Democratic opponent, Katie McGinty. Toomey tacked to the center in the campaign, touting his support 3 years ago for gun background checks, and even running an ad featuring video of President Obama praising his political courage. Safely reelected, Toomey last night returned to the message that makes him one of the most conservative members of Congress.
I don't think the government should be wasting as much money as it wastes. I don't think it should be spending as much of your money as it spends. I don't think taxes should be as high as they are. I don't think the federal government should be stifling our economy by overregulating businesses. I don't think Washington should be making health care decisions for all of us.
Katie McGinty wasn't the Democrats' first choice to run against Toomey and was considered a less-than-inspired candidate. A downbeat McGinty told supporters last night she'll stick with the principles she ran on.
I want to be part of making sure that decent, honorable, humble, hardworking people in Pennsylvania can look their kids in the eyes. And when they put in their 40 hours, they can say to their kids, I got you.
Toomey's margin of victory was less than 2 percentage points. For Here and Now, I'm Dave Davies in Philadelphia.
Well, as we wrap up this hour of coverage, let's get the big picture with Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd, who's been following all the races going on around the country. Peter, let's start with the Senate and the balance of power in Congress.
Yeah, just 24 hours ago, Jeremy, we were all wondering whether or not Democrats would flip the Senate. The answer is a resounding no. 51 Republicans right now, as it stands, 47 Democrats. Now, there's a couple of races that are still up in the air in New Hampshire. It's the fight between Maggie Hassan, the Democrat, the governor, and the Republican incumbent, Kelly Ayotte. Now, Ayotte is behind. If you remember, Ayotte came out and said that she was not in support of Donald Trump after that now infamous video came out. But even if she loses, it's not going to matter because the Republicans are going to keep control of the Senate. An interesting race out in Nevada as well. Catherine Cortez Masto beats the Republican Congressman Joe Heck for the Senate. Now, the Democrats really wanted this one. I went to Nevada a couple of times this year, and they worked very hard to elect the first Latina senator. But again, it's not going to matter because the Republicans are in control of the Senate.
Right. Talk about North Carolina, swing state. It did go for Trump, but the governor's race there.
Governor's race is really big, and it has not been called yet. So it's between the Republican governor, Pat McCrory, who is behind the Democrat, Roy Cooper. Now, they've both got like 2.28-ish million votes. McCrory has refused to concede. Now, this race is all about House Bill 2. If you remember, that was the transgender bathroom bill. McCrory signed the law. He supported it. His opponent, Cooper, basically tried to use it against him, and it looked like it might have worked. That's a very, very close race.
Yeah.
Peter, you've been following some of the ballot measures across the country, minimum wage and other things. And I also want you to tell us what happened with the health care measure in Colorado that would have established universal health care there.
Well, Jeremy, you were out in Colorado just a couple weeks ago and you were reporting on this fascinating question here. This had some hints of Bernie Sanders. It would have covered all state residents in Colorado with universal health care. But here's the deal. It was very, very expensive, about $25 billion in payroll tax increases in the first year alone. So, Jeremy, you know from your reporting that that was a really tough pill right. to swallow for folks out in Colorado.
Yeah.
So it did not pass.
It did not pass.
What you're
Excuse
saying.
Me. No, yeah. I left out the most important information, which was that it lost badly, like 80 to 20%.
Uh-huh. Well, Peter O'Dowd, you can be forgiven. We have been here for many hours here today. And we know that the listeners as well, a lot of people up very, very late last night. A lot of millions of Americans are celebrating that they put their faith in someone that no one felt could be president of the United States, and he is going to be. There are, of course, millions of other Americans who are profoundly disappointed they didn't see the first female president of the United States. So this is something we will probably be talking about for a long time to come. You agree, Jeremy?
I do, and I do want to also say, as we wrap up this marathon coverage from Here and Now, thanks to our great staff.
Yeah. Did everyone get a piece of pizza?
I got a cookie.
Okay, a cookie. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson in Washington at NPR Election Headquarters. This is Here and Now.